Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of today's morning show talking about a glorious event which occurs each and every summer, usually in early August, right here in Kenosha, the Pike River Rendezvous, this year the 19th annual. At the end of the program, we'll spend a few minutes talking about this year's Starving Artists Fair, which is up in Racine on Sunday. But Saturday and Sunday, August 6th and 7th, you have the opportunity to step back in time in a truly remarkable way, back into the early history of the Upper Midwest and Wisconsin, back into the era of the fur traders. With us today on the morning show is Nancy Matthews, who has joined us any number of occasions to talk about the Pike River Rendezvous, which is an event that she really shepherds and coordinates. She is now Director of Interpretation at the Kenosha Public Museum. It's under their auspices that this event takes place each and every year. And I'm really happy that Nancy has brought with her this year Mike Elam, who has joined us at least once or twice before on the morning show to talk about the Pike River Rendezvous. He is one of the reenactors who helps bring this event to life. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Good to have both of you here. Nancy, let's not take a whole lot of time with it, but please explain the intriguing title of Director of Interpretation.
Well, about 3 years ago, the museum went through a reorganization, and at that time, I was Senior Curator of Education and oversaw the Education Department, and the newly crowned Executive Director of the museum's Dan Joyce, as part of the reorganization, thought that it would be beneficial for the museum to have one person to oversee the Education Exhibits and Collections Department, because really those three departments work together very intimately in the creation of not only the exhibits, but all of the programming or the interpretation of the collections. We interpret our collections through exhibitions and through programming. So I work very closely with Rachel Cleese Anderson, who is our curator of exhibits, Doug Dahman, who's manager of the education department, and Gina Redont, who's the curator of collections.
Very good. And the museum seemed to be thriving as much as ever. Every time I'm there, it just seems incredibly busy and joyful and lively.
Exactly. The museums have been very thriving, and we have had an extraordinary summer, and it's not even over yet. Our attendance just in July, I believe, was up 8,000. Mm-hmm. I think at Kenosha Public Museum alone, we had 34,000 people through the door. So we had a very successful art fair in July, plus Pokemon Go has been very good to us as well. And as well as a lot of the exhibits, the Transparent Watercolor Society of America exhibit is always popular. This is the last week for that exhibition. It does close on Sunday, so if you haven't seen that stunning show, please come down and see it. But the Civil War Museum has done very well, and of course the dinosaurs are always popular, the Dinosaur Discovery Museum.
So you are a part of something really vibrant and essential here in Kenosha, and how exciting. And of course, this has been your baby, the Pike River Rendezvous, for a long, long time.
Well, I can't take total credit for it because it is a collaboration with the museums and the city. We work very closely with the Parks Department as well as city administration. Chris Coachman, who's the oversees the special events for the city, does a lot of our promotion for the event. And then, of course, the reenactors that we work with, particularly Kathy and Ernie Craik and Mike Elam, kind of coordinate the reenactors. So they do a lot of that legwork, whereas I call the meetings, take the minutes, make sure, you know, the schedule's done, the parking passes are printed, a lot of that kind of unfun behind-the-scenes work.
Which is, we're nevertheless grateful, happens. Mike, how many of these Pike River Rendezvous have you been a part of as a reenactor?
From day one, when the city came to us, there were originally three of us. Myself, Ernie, and Don Lovelace were contacted, and the original rendezvous was set up to kind of publicize Poreo Park. We have a huge nature center there that nobody even knew existed. The only thing that anybody knew about was the baseball diamonds. And the city wanted to make people aware of that, and they felt that this type of event would be something that would bring people in, and they would know that, you know, we've had this park system that's just fantastic, but nobody's using it. And then we did 6 years there, and then we moved to Simmons Island to be in conjunction with the Tall Ships being here, and just kept the location where we are now.
That home just was a little more comfortable, I suppose.
It was a little more comfortable with the lake breeze coming in, plus a lot more room to spread out. And the rendezvous now does encompass pretty much all of the Simmons Island area up to Kennedy Park.
Right. So it was the city who came to you saying we want to have some kind of event that highlights this park. What kind of conversations went on about what we should do, or almost immediately did you end up gravitating to what ended up
taking? I think Nick Arnold kind of had something in mind, and Todd Ingruel, who worked for the City Parks Department, they got in touch with the reenactors. The city was just kind of called in on the side to provide some educational hands-on kinds of programming, and it took a few years before the museums became a much more integral part of the event. But Mike was part of that original conversation.
Right. We sat down with Todd Ingruel and had a couple of meetings and explained logistically, this is what we need in order to put on this type of event. We then went before the Parks Commission and presented the plan to them that here's what we need budget-wise and facilities, and they wholeheartedly approved it. Fortunately, we've got some history buffs in the council, and they were behind it 100%, and we put it together. Took a lot of work that first year to get it ready, and we slowly grew. We haven't been trying to grow and be huge. We add a couple of people every year, but it's based on what the people demonstrate mainly is when we add people.
Right. I don't think we've yet spelled out exactly the era in Wisconsin history that is brought to life in the Pike River Rendezvous. And, of course, many people listening are already somewhat aware of the event. But for someone who's maybe new to the area or for whatever reason has just never managed to get there, explain exactly what facet of Wisconsin history is brought to life in the Pike River Rendezvous.
The rendezvous actually encompasses the years, about 200 years of history from about 1650 to the mid-1800s. And this really is the beginning of European history in Wisconsin, with the Europeans coming in and establishing trade networks with the Native Americans that were here. The fur trade, this time of year, I always do a little cramming to get ready for the rendezvous. And it's been interesting this year. It seems like every year I come up with a new piece of information. And one thing that I didn't realize was that in the 1500s, Basque fishermen were coming from Europe and fishing in North Atlantic in the Grand Banks and had contact with the native peoples of Canada and discovered that they were wearing beaver coats and traded with them. Because these coats were obviously much more warm for them on the North Atlantic, and then their journey back to Spain and France. Once they got the coats back to Europe, people were very excited because beaver felt hats were the fashion in Europe. Hats were extremely important to men for keeping their heads warm and for keeping them cool and dry. And beaver fur is very water repellent, and so the beaver coats were quickly, you know, absconded and turned into beaver felt hats because Europeans had depleted the population of beavers in Europe.
So often human beings are wont to do.
Exactly. And so, you know, as more Europeans came into North America, they brought trappers with them who trapped beaver, but also established these trade networks with the native peoples that were here. And that completely changed many native cultures, because this was a whole new way of getting goods and services, and goods that they had never had before, that that had a big impact on their life. You know, metal kettles and guns and ammunition and beads and bells and mirrors and just all kinds of European produced goods
that they didn't even know existed.
They didn't know existed, and made their life so much easier. I mean, European produced fabrics where they didn't have to go out and shoot a deer and then skin it and tan it and then create, you know, a dress or pants out of it. So, the beaver it was the impetus for the this 200 years of history. And then things kind of fell apart in the mid-1800s when silk hats became the rage. And so then the focus switched to Asia.
Right. You've brought a little show-and-tell item with you that's of limited use over the radio, but it's
exactly,
fun for me to see.
Exactly. I did bring a beaver pelt with me, and this will be at the Laughing Fox Tavern, which is part of the family activity area. And, of course, there will be other camps that will have beaver.
I usually have a half a dozen or so there to at least give the impression that I'm a successful trapper.
Right.
But to create beaver felt was an incredibly complicated process. I was reading up on it, and there are just way too many steps to even mention now. But beaver pelt has very long what are called guard hairs, but it's the really soft, fuzzy under fur, which was what they were going for to create the felt. And one part of the step to remove the guard hairs, a solution of, I think it's sodium nitrate, was applied. And the nitrate of mercury or something like that, but it's got mercury in it. And mercury actually attacked the nervous system of the hatters. And it caused them to lose muscle control and garbled speech and everything. So the term mad as a hatter came about as a result of processing the beaver pelts to make
they would make a paste out of the under fur, which they would trim off, and then they would form it onto the wooden molds to create the hats. And even when I was in grade school, we would play with mercury and things like that. Nobody realized it was absorbed through the skin, and the brain is one of the first things it attacks. And
wow.
Like Nancy said, thus the term mad as a hatter. It was an occupation that didn't have a very good life expectancy.
I suppose not. Wow. Can I take a hold of this for just a second? I'm just curious to... Oh, my word, that's soft and beautiful, isn't it? Wow. You can see why it would be of interest.
There were two types of beaver that were actually traded, and the one that was most valued was the coat beaver, the ones that were coming in the coats. And then the other was what was called the parchment beaver, which were just the pelts that were, you know, stretched out and stacked and bundled up and ready for trade.
Mike, say a word about the relationship between Native Americans and European trappers who came into the region. She's already talked about at least one consequence of that relationship was that the Indians or the Native Americans ended up gaining access to new technologies and new resources and luxuries that they didn't even know about before, for good or ill. Explain a little more about the relationship. I mean, the way in which maybe one side helped the other. What do we know about that?
Well, a lot of the trappers, especially as they move further west, got a very close relationship with the native tribes. And many of the trappers would marry into the tribes, which would give them access to more trapping grounds. And it was beneficial for both parties. because like Nancy said, that allowed the Native Americans to have access to various trade goods, the steel knives instead of a flint knife, different things like that. It afforded protection for the trappers and gave them access to the hunting grounds that the natives were in. Hmm. So it was a beneficial event for both parties.
What do we know about the kind of agreements that were brokered and how formal this relationship would be? I mean, would it vary widely from tribe to tribe and from trapper to trapper, or were there kind of more sweeping agreements that were brokered?
No, it was scattered. Certain tribes really didn't like the intrusion of the white men, where others accepted them wholly. Hmm. So there was a lot of variation. It's, you know, but like relationships now with the different people in modern society.
Right. What about over the course of this, well, two centuries we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, were these relationships that grew more positive over time, or over time were these relationships fraught with more tension, or generally speaking, was this by and large a fairly consistent kind of coexistence that was
A lot of it depended on area, and you're talking a period of a couple hundred years. So there was a roller coaster ride. You know, there was peace and tranquility, and then there was hostility. It just a lot of variation.
And there were actually five different European countries that were all in competition to get access to the beaver. The British, the Dutch, let's see if I can remember them all, the French, the Spanish, and the Russians. Mm. So you've got some tension even within Europe as to access to different trade routes. And really, the fur trade was the first big industry that was established in North America. The Hudson Bay Company was established to send out traders and big birch bark canoes, and that's a whole nother story, just their lifestyle in itself. But to take goods out and to trade, to get to places like Upper Minnesota, what's the place where the big rendezvous is?
Grand Portage.
Grand Portage, I'm sorry. And they still have a big rendezvous reenactment there every year. But the Hudson Bay Company is still in the works.
All these years later,
yeah, exactly.
So explain what this neck of the woods was like in this era and what role we played. We sort of imagine that we weren't the prime countryside for some of this trapping to occur, or was this prime territory once upon a time?
This area here is kind of on the trade route. The big canoes would come down the lakes and would transport goods and services around the lakes. Villa Louis over at Prairie du Chien, that was built by a trader. And that was at the conjunction of the Wisconsin and the Mississippi River. And he had a trading post there which dealt with the fur trade and became very successful. The big mansion that's on the property, that was built with earnings from the fur trade. Hmm. It was a location where, coming down the Wisconsin River from all of the tributaries and everything, the furs all came down to that point, and then they were transported down the Mississippi from there.
Hmm. In some ways, that mansion really helps embody or represent just how lucrative this whole industry was.
And there were trading posts in this area, none in Kenosha proper, but in Franksville, the Vaux brothers had a trading post, and Dan Joyce and Dr. Bob Sasso from Parkside had worked many years to try and locate where that trading post was, and a few years ago they did find evidence of the foundation. But the Vaux brothers' father had a trading post in Milwaukee and was probably the first European to put up a building in what is now the city of Milwaukee. Hmm. And so trading post was the first business established in Milwaukee.
Wow. Remind us of how all of this went away.
Well, as I mentioned, about 1850, 1860, the fur trade pretty much came to an end with the introduction of silk hats, obviously from silk being introduced from Asia. And it really had an impact on, obviously, the Native American cultures that over the course of 200 years had become dependent on the fur trade for goods and services. And actually, there were certain social aspects of cultures that had changed within Native American culture too. It's like the men were focusing on trapping beaver and trading, and they would be gone for months at a time, leaving the women behind to basically run the villages. And now, without the trade networks, the men are home.
Mm.
plus they had developed this dependence on American and European produced goods. So, and we pretty much know the rest of that history of the 1800s and the impact the U.S. government had on Native American cultures.
Right. So we have the fickle world of fashion to thank for
exactly. It's amazing that just a simple thing like that can have such an impact on history and culture.
Right. So let's talk about the Pike River Rendezvous. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Nancy Matthews and Mike Elam, who are two of the most significant and busiest participants and coordinators of the Pike River Rendezvous, the 9th annual Pike River Rendezvous.
19th.
What did I say?
9th.
Oh, 19th, yes. We can't lose 10 years of this wonderful tradition. The 19th Pike River Rendezvous is this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So for those who come and visit the Pike River Rendezvous, describe what it is that they see and experience.
First of all, it's free. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't get any better than that. We are on Simmons Island. The best way to get there is to come, I believe it's 44th Avenue, to Kennedy Park, and park in Kennedy Park, and you can board a wagon drawn by horses, and it will deliver you basically to one of the many doors of the rendezvous. And then you will walk through the re-encampment. Be sure you pick up one of the lime green schedules, which lists all of the different musical performances and competitions and other entertainment that happen throughout the day. There are food vendors. There are vendors that will have traditional kinds of fur trading era beads and clothing. And for reenactors, there are vendors that sell cloth and patterns to make clothing, ready-made clothing. There are period toys for kids. We have a candy vendor, kettle corn. Blacksmith. We've got a blacksmith again this year. We're very happy to have a blacksmith back. So just all kinds of very family-friendly activities. You will find me in period costume at the Laughing Fox Tavern, where we have a variety of family activities. At the tavern, we talk about the role of the tavern during the fur trade. We have very typical kinds of tavern games as well as kids' games. And kids love playing graces, which is a hoop and stick kind of game, spinning tops and rolling the ball to knock down the nine pins. We have a daily chores area where they really get into washing clothes and washing dishes and grinding corn. And then they can make a corn husk doll and a beaded necklace. And then a lot of the camps will have demonstrations going on. Actually, one of the reenactors that's set up right next to our area is a candle maker. And we actually have a Girl Scout program on Saturday morning where they're earning their Playing with the Past badge. Ah. We're calling it Rendezvous with the Past. And they will be making traditional women's mob caps and beaded necklaces and cornhusk dolls and doing the daily chores and playing the games, seeing how candles are made. And one of the highlights is visiting Mr. Elam in his teepee.
Mm. Tell us more about that.
One of my vestiges of the past. As I explained, I portray a Rocky Mountain free trapper who has come back east because, as Nancy said, the transition is going to silk hats. There's not as many beaver in the mountains. There's not that much demand for them. So I've come back east, but I brought my teepee with me. It's a vestige of the past, and I explain what life like a Rocky Mountain trapper is. One of the things that we try to do at the Rendezvous is represent all of the occupations that people would have had during this 200 years. Not everybody in this country was a trapper or a trader. We have our people carding and spinning wool. We have our tinkers and our silversmiths and our flint knappers and our blacksmith. Anybody that had an occupation during that time, we want to show people, here's what your ancestors did to survive to get to the point where we are today. You know, we're not all descended from a bunch of computer programmers or rocket scientists or broadcasters. You know, most of our ancestors were self-employed up prior to the Industrial Revolution. They were merchants, tavern keepers. You know, most of them worked very hard. I come from a long line of farmers that settled in Virginia in the early 1600s. Hmm.
And when is it that you first got interested in reenacting?
I visited a Rendezvous almost 40 years ago. And I've been
a Rendezvous similar to this event, you mean?
A Rendezvous similar to this, a lot smaller event. And I've always, you know, growing up through grade school, science and history were my favorite subjects. And I visited the Rendezvous, got talking to the people, learned what I needed to get started in it. And it was a slow transition. You're never done. You're always learning something new and realizing, well, you know, you thought this was period correct, but it really isn't. So the outfit or the gear has to be changed. But it's a constant learning process. My library grows by several books every year. I spend a lot of time visiting historical sites and museums. And
how many of these kind of events do you do? I assume you don't just reenact at the Pike River Rendezvous.
Well, this year I'm only doing this one, and then there's one other one similar to ours, but a smaller event. A couple of our reenactors put one on out at Union Grove at the county fairgrounds.
Ah, okay.
And it covers a little bit longer timeline than ours does. Theirs goes up to the Second World War, so we have a lot of military reenactors out there.
Hmm. Nancy, I know that one of the things that maybe sets this event apart, or I think it's something that's really worth acknowledging, is the fact that you really try to watch the details in order to really create rich authenticity, even into the sort of the nicks and crannies of the event. And I suspect there are certain events that maybe aren't quite so careful about some of those things, such as the kind of food that's prepared and that kind of thing. Just
exactly.
Say a word about that.
Well, first of all of the camps, the reenactors have been invited to participate. Based on the quality of their camp and the educational content and their demonstrations that they do. I have been to a very, very large reenactment in Indiana, which I always wanted to go to and was very excited and was just absolutely overwhelmed that it felt to me just like going to Mall of America because it was just one vendor after another. And, I mean, the Boy Scouts had you know, were vending, and it just really kind of lost some of that authenticity. And I think being down on Simmons Island and being right there on and the lakeshore provides such a natural environment. And this is where these interactions took place. I mean, the Potawatomi camped on Simmons Island. So there is just so much history inherent in that location. And, you know, using the horse-drawn wagon shuttle to keep cars kind of at a distance from the reenactment. Obviously, reenactors come with a lot of equipment, including trucks and trailers and everything. So they're kind of kept on the periphery as much as possible. But we try and keep the encampment as authentic as possible. The volunteers from the museum that work at the family activity area are required to dress in period clothing. The museum provides all that for them.
So when somebody comes to this, they really have kind of an uncanny sense of stepping back in time.
Exactly. And reenactors are already setting up. I know Mike's teepee is up. I saw it yesterday. And so they're moving in. You're not going to see everybody in costume or in period clothing today as they're getting set up. But for sure, Saturday and Sunday, everybody will be ready to rock and roll.
Right. Are there dramatic differences between what happens Saturday and Sunday?
Not really. The schedule is very similar. There are a couple of, well, for instance, on Saturday, there's an opening ceremony, which you're not going to have on Sunday. Sunday, there is actually a church service at 9 o'clock. So there are some subtle differences between the 2 days.
Typically, when people come, how long do they come? I mean, how long do they stay? Or how long does it make sense for someone to stay?
That varies. You could spend all day and still not see everything that's going on. We try to make it a hands-on history. We don't just show you what somebody does. We invite you to, all right, try this. The people that are carding and spinning wool, they're going to have people learn how to do it. If somebody wants to start a fire with a rock and a chunk of steel, we will teach you how to do it. We have our tomahawk and knife blocks where we teach people to throw knives and tomahawks. And pretty much any of the skills, we'll have them help out. A lot of times the blacksmiths will have the kids there pumping the bellows to show them how much work it is. We want you to get involved. We don't want it to be like the museum where you can walk through and look at it, but you can't touch anything.
That's not necessarily true of the Kenosha Public Museum.
No, you do have areas, but I mean the majority of it is a display where you look at it.
Well, and certainly museums in general, we don't often think of them in that way, although that's a way in which some museums are changing.
Exactly. Yes.
But this is a dramatic step in the other direction where it's all about getting
hands-on. We want people to have hands-on and get involved in it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really understand how easy or how difficult something is until you actually do it.
Absolutely.
And as I mentioned, we have a Girl Scout program. Just so everybody knows, this is a pre-registered thing, so registration is now closed. But the program itself is 2.5 hours. And I know last year many of the Girl Scouts and their leaders and families stayed long after the program was over. In fact, one mom commented to me, she was from the Milwaukee area, she said, "I had no idea that this was going on." And so she was very enthralled and indicated that they would be back. So.
Great. Well, it looks like, at a glance at least, it's going to be a beautiful weekend weather-wise. I'm looking here ahead, Saturday, sunny and warm, a high of 80. Sunday, sunny and pleasant, high of 78.
That doesn't get any better than that.
Yes, it should be
great.
And the humidity is supposed to be lower. It was brutal out there setting up on the island yesterday. The heat and the humidity are not our friends.
Right. Well, and today is going to be the hottest
day
of the week.
Today's going to be just as bad.
So, today's going to be a survival day.
Right. Yeah. Well, good. You have your teepee up safe and sound already.
I have my teepee up. I'm pumping fluids into the body as quick as I can consume them. That was the case all day yesterday as well.
Well, we're glad you survived that and are ready to once again be part of this vibrant event. So this is Saturday and Sunday, 9 to 4, the Pike River Rendezvous.
The hours on Saturday are 9 to 5 and Sunday from 9 to 4.
And just once again, Nancy, real quick, how do people find the Pike River Rendezvous? How do they get there?
And the Pike River Rendezvous is located on Simmons Island between 50th Street and about 44th Street on the north.
Yeah, well, 45th is the boat landing, and 44th is the road that they'll take to the parking.
Yeah, so it's right down on the lakefront. Parking is highly recommended in Kennedy Park, and you can then access the reenactment either by foot or by taking the horse-drawn shuttle. So again, this is a free family event. It doesn't get any better than that.
Nah, I couldn't agree more. Nancy Matthews and Mike Elam, great to have both of you here. Thank you for all of your hard work on behalf of this wonderful event, and we hope a lot of people will take advantage of the opportunity to experience the 2016 Pike River Rendezvous this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Thanks again for being part of the morning show. Right.
Thanks, Greg.
Here's part two. In addition to everything else going on this weekend in southeastern Wisconsin, one of my favorite events is the Starving Artists Fair in Racine. It takes place on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College, right there along the lake. And it is always an exciting and fun opportunity to enjoy some beautiful artwork at reasonable prices. And I'm very happy to spend this second portion of today's morning show with Joe Nissen, who is a member of the board of the Racine Art Guild. And that is the organization under whose auspices the Starving Artist Fair takes place every year, the first weekend in August. This is the 49th Starving Artist Fair in Racine. And Joe Nissen, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you here. And could we begin with just a quick word about the mission or purpose of the Racine Art Guild? Why does this organization exist?
We are here to promote art and to have an avenue for artists. Many of them paint, and their basements are filled with paintings and ceramics, and they have no place to show it nor to sell it. So we want to encourage them. And we promote artists who are frequently amateurs, many of them very gifted, but this gives them an avenue for their work.
And this specific event, I understand, is really your major fundraiser. And what is primarily done with the funds raised from the Starving Artist Fair?
Our purpose for this is to give scholarships to arts majors, and primarily in Racine and Kenosha, who are in the third or fourth year of their training in college. And we give them, and it varies from about $500 to $700. So we try very hard to encourage these young people in artwork. And some of their work is phenomenal. Then we invite them to come back to one of our meetings and talk about what they have done. It's a show and tell opportunity. Hmm. And so we get to look at their work and we get to hear them. They bring their families in. They're thrilled, of course.
Wow.
There aren't that many art scholarships going on in the world today.
Great. Well, that is a certainly fine reason to have such an event, which I know many people enjoy, and it's the 49th, so you'll be gearing up for an extra special celebration next year. How long have you been part of this?
I am a charter member. I was in an art class with a group of people. We were taking a contemporary modern art painting class, and the instructor from Kenosha, his name was John Garay, said, you know, many of you people are very gifted. You should be showing your work. And we looked at each other and said, all right, we should do that. So we found a spot of land next to a grocery store. We cleaned it up and scheduled it and put out little maps so that people could be there. Then we put out several signs around the city and on a Sunday morning, and we said, we're going to sit here and wait and see if anybody shows up. And wouldn't you know, people came out. We were absolutely astonished. People are hungry to look at art, to buy it at reasonable prices. And we were able to do that. It was thrilling for all of us.
Mm. I know that one of the hallmarks of this particular event is the fact that this is a juried event. That is, not just any Tom, Dick, or Harry can show up with their art, but that there is a process by which artists of a certain level of skill and talent, I suppose, are permitted to be part of this. Am I characterizing that correctly?
That's correct. All of the artists are juried. We want to ensure that their work is original, and we don't want people to paint on paper napkins and call it art. So we really do look for original work. And the quality, therefore, from these artists is really very considerable, very high. So we will find this year particularly we have glasswork, ceramics, so that our crafts are high-end crafts, as well as photography, painting, watercolors, sometimes fabric. And there really is lots of jewelry, of course, lots of jewelry. And with that, we are very particular about that as well.
So how many artists are we talking about? Do you have the number in your head of how many artists will be showing their work this year?
It's about 100.
Mm-hmm.
We usually have that many. So it hangs usually around there between, say, 95 to 105.
And, of course, one of the fun things about an event like this is so many artists especially enjoy it and appreciate the opportunity and return year after year after year. And you look forward to seeing those familiar faces at the same time that you also get to encounter brand new artists and their work for the first time.
Absolutely. And many of these artists say, I want to be in the same spot I was in last year and the year before. And they request this corner, this spot, because then their customers know where they are as well as it might be a shady place. They bring their own tent. They put up their tents. They come in the Sunday morning. It's always the first Sunday in August. And I am there at 5 o'clock to put on the coffee. But the artists start coming in anywhere after 6 o'clock. We'd ask them to come in at 7, but some would come in the night before if they could. So 7 o'clock, they start setting up. They bring a lot of work, the ceramics and the glassware, and their art is very precious. So they ensure that it's under tents, that it is also well displayed. So it takes considerable thought. Many of these artists do the art fair circuit. They go from place to place to place around the state. And it's exciting because people, their customers will say, I saw him last year in Milwaukee, and I knew he's going to be here in Racine this year. I want to see him again. So
artists have their own following.
They have their own following.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet is that this is called the Starving Artists Fair, which is, of course, kind of an interesting title, and it probably represents a couple of different things, including the fact that some of these are young artists who aren't exactly starving, of course, but in many cases it's young artists on their way up hoping to create for themselves an increasingly successful career. But I think that term starving artists also has something to do with the kind of price tags that are attached to the art. Is there some sort of specific limit, or is it just sort of a generally understood concept that this is not outrageously priced artwork?
The highest it will be is $225.
So nothing will cost more than that.
That's right. So you should be able to find something. This is a great opportunity to do your Christmas shopping because the work is so unique, and you will find something that you will not find in a department store. And so with this opportunity, it is just a great place to do your shopping. And we have people who do that, who come in and say, I'm looking for something unique. Or I know this artist, he's been here before, and he was always in this corner. And is he here again this year? The area is mapped out in sections 10 by 10 feet. And so there is enough room for them to show their work. And they do. They do. It's great fun.
It really is. And I love the layout of it with the sort of the diagonal aisles which I think helps you sort of keep things straight in terms of who is where, as opposed to if everything was sort of laid out in sort of boring rectangles, it's just a little harder to know exactly where you are or where a particular artist is, who's to whose booth you want to return or whatever. It's just, and it's beautiful then. They're right there by the lake. It's a lovely place for this to occur. I want to make sure you have a chance to talk about some of the components of this art fair beyond what you've just described, the 100 some artists who will be there in these booths showing their wares. What else do people experience at the Starving Artist Fair?
Well, they get something to eat. We always have food. We have the cowboy kettle corn man, who is very generously donates his popcorn to various artists and the volunteers. Oh. We're always grateful to have him come along. This year we have some Mexican food. We have hot dogs, ice cream. There's a cupcake lady this year. She is new with us.
Wow.
And so that will be interesting. Wow. Then, of course, we have music, and we always put music out there. So we have the panpipes. And we have a string group. We have, let's see, what else have I got here? Young Strings, and we have guitarists. So there are just a variety of things. Vocalists as well. So there should be music. So it's not just dead silence. It's warm and pleasant, a little breeze with the leaves of the trees sashaying through there. It's just very, very warm and pleasant. And this year, we're doing a couple of other things. There should be some face painting. We have tried to garner someone to do that. And also, we've got art that everybody can paint. So we're having a canvas, and you just come in and put your brush to the big old canvas and see what you can contribute.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So,
what a wonderful idea.
Yeah, we call it All About Art.
Oh,
and
great.
Everybody just put in your brush and draw something. Mother, and it doesn't have to be outstanding. It needs to be a sunshine, a building, an airplane, something for the children to paint as well. It's something for all of us.
Terrific. And I know that there's also usually a raffle that goes on to help generate still more money for your organization and for the scholarships you want to give. Explain what gets raffled off. This is such a wonderful thing.
Well, this year we are doing end tables. And the artists have gathered a variety of tables. There should be 9 or 10 of them this year. They finish them off. These are old end tables, things that people are throwing away. They clean them up, and then they paint them. Wonderful designs. We had done this a few years ago, and the work was absolutely outstanding. And it is a raffle. And so you just bid on it. They are gorgeous, and people get to go home with wonderful tables that you will never find in a furniture store.
Right, or anywhere else. Absolutely unique pieces. That's great. So this event is coming up on Sunday, the first Sunday in August, as always. When does it open and when does it close?
Well, the artists get there at 7, supposedly, and it runs from 9 in the morning through 4 in the afternoon.
And in the case of a bit of inclement weather, the event goes on, essentially rain or shine?
Yes, but please, no major storms.
Yeah.
Please, no. We pray for pleasant, sunny days. Once in a while, we'll have a sprinkle, but this is August, and usually the weather is pretty good.
Right. That's my recollection, and we'll hope for the same for this Sunday, 9 to 4, the 49th Annual Starving Artist Fair in Racine. Joe Nissen on the board of the Racine Art Guild. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I hope that you can listen to the interview which I'll be airing with Konstantin Markidis, a professional writer, a former competitive swimmer, and the co-author of a really intriguing memoir called Chasing Waters, which celebrates the life and the career of one of America's most talented and intriguing competitive swimmers, a sprinter by the name of Anthony Irvin, who won a gold medal back in 2000. He is competing in the Rio Olympic Games, which open tomorrow. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses.